Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Beijing, China, and speak with John Gressner, the principal and founder of Intercedent, a Canadian business and investment advisory firm. He served as the head of the Canada-China Trade Council in Beijing and has lived and worked in China for over 30 years. We'll discuss the health of the Chinese economy in terms of reality and perceptions following Black Monday on the Shanghai Stock Exchange that triggered a global sell-off of stocks that wiped out about $6 trillion of value to investors worldwide. Then we'll examine the behind-the-scenes diplomacy involving meetings between Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Syria, as well as meetings between Iran and Syria that raise the possibility of a settlement of the Syrian civil war that has killed over 250,000 and displaced half the population. David Lesh, a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio and the author of Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, joins us to discuss the ruling Assad clan's loss of 83% of the country's territory as the Islamic State destroys historical treasures at the UNESCO World Heritage Sites at Palmyra, as well as the end of the current war and the beginning of the next war in Syria. Then finally, we will look into President Obama's speech at Monday's National Clean Energy Summit in Las Vegas and get an assessment from David Freeman, a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He is the former head of the TVA, New York Power, and the Los Angeles DWP, and we will discuss the need for political courage in mandating a total and complete switch to renewable energy instead of replacing one atmospheric poison, coal, with another natural gas that emits methane. And joining us now from Beijing is John Gressner, who is the principal and founder of Intercedent, a Canadian business and investment advisory firm founded in 1988 and focused on Asia. Mr. Gressner served as the head of the Canada-China Trade Council in Beijing and has lived and worked in China for over 30 years. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Gressner.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And China, of course, is where this sort of global contagion in the stock market crash yesterday began with the so-called Black Monday in Shanghai. How much is this panic that goes on in the stock markets based upon perceptions versus reality? Is it indeed true that the Chinese economy is going to slow and that the price of oil therefore must come down?
Well, I think a lot of it is definitely a psychological impact. We, what I call the CNNP ping effect, that news moves around the world very quickly, but I'm not sure most people have the time to understand it. Obviously, the Chinese economy is, and this has been predicted for a few years by the World Bank and IMF, is slowing down, but I think people have to put it into a context.
And what context would you put it in then?
Well, we've had unprecedented growth since 1979 with a few years of contraction in the late 80s and early 90s. But by and large, we've, you know, the economy's been growing between 7% and 12% for almost three decades. And what we're seeing now is possibly, you know, it's statistically 7% growth, but more likely headed towards 5% growth. But to put that into context, my general point is that when the U.S. started engaging China in the early 80s, the Chinese GDP was $384 billion in 1984. And now the 5% growth on a $10 trillion base, which is in some people's calculations is lower than the actual size of the economy, is still quite significant. Contribution both to world growth and obviously even within the domestic context, still significant growth when benchmarked against other more mature economies. So I'm not as pessimistic as perhaps the market suggests, but obviously there are areas of concern going forward in China, especially for commodities players. But I think that you'll find when you look at customs data over the next 6 months that copper and other imports are actually quite healthy, and the Chinese are taking advantage of some of the prices in the global commodity market.
Well, it would seem, though, that a lot of the devaluations and the extent to which the Chinese government was trying to get its hands around the stock market in terms of having encouraged people to buy on margin has led a lot of commentators to suggest that the government is either slow in reacting or can't get its hands around. I mean, it seems a bit strange to me, criticism particularly coming here from the United States, where it would seem our economy is actually much more fragile than the Chinese economy, because with all this quantitative easing that's gone on, almost all of the Fed's money has gone to the banks and not to the real economy. And my understanding in China, with the huge investment in infrastructure, that the Chinese government has been investing largely in the real economy in China.
Certainly since the economic stimulus in 2009, there was a focus, obviously, in one level of propping up banks, but it was less severe than we had in the United States in 2008 when the Treasury Department moved in to stabilize your financial markets. And China has, you know, putting a lot of money into infrastructure. And I think people have to put that in context as well. And there are fellow China watchers and certainly macroeconomists have warned about the rate of return on some of this infrastructure from a financial point of view. But if you look at it in terms of where China's rail plan and China's port plan and highway plan is going in terms of number of kilometers, in some cases China, obviously a significantly larger population base than the U.S. In some areas, China is still behind in terms of kilometers as a country in rail compared to the U.S. So I think that there was a rational motivation to keep the economy going. They're hoping to transfer some of that infrastructure investment through AIB and the Silk Road and announcement in building a rail across the Amazon to keep some of their heavy industry going while they reposition the economy ideally towards a more services-oriented and consumption-oriented model. But that's not going to be happening overnight.
But in terms of China's ability to move, if you will, the People's Bank of China cut its key lending rate by 0.25 percentage points to 4.6%. Now, in the case of the U.S., we're 7 years from the last recession. If there's nowhere we can go, is there? I mean, we're almost at zero.
Well, if you want a comparative analysis, certainly there's a lot more leeway at the PBOC or central bank level here. I think that even the recent currency valuation in China was probably, to a certain extent, misunderstood by a lot of the Western analysts. The bandwidth of the currency trading was actually requested to be expanded by the IMF as part of China's goal to full convertibility. And if you compare it against where I'm from, the Canadian dollar, we've fallen 25-26% against the U.S. dollar in the last 8 months. So China recorrected its currency. But, you know, the United States, Europe, Canada, certainly from a central bank point of view, you know, and it's an overused analogy now that there are very few tools left in the toolbox. But I think you can also point to the fact that the U.S., there is, in a number of areas, a robust return to the potential for growth. There's a lot of corporate earnings that are parked. There's a stabilization of the housing market. There's some positive indications in the last 6-9 months on the job market. Exports are stabilizing. So I think, you know, the U.S. has to recognize that if it wants to move forward, it has to unlink its emotional and psychological ties to the Chinese economy and just move forward.
Well, speaking of that, of course, we are in an election year, even though it is next year. But nevertheless, the candidates are out there, and there's quite a number of them on the Republican side, many of whom are China bashers, particularly Donald Trump and Governor Scott Walker. What kind of a response is there in China about this kind of nativism coming from American political candidates?
I think at the central government level, they've, in the foreign affairs ministry level, they understand that there's a certain amount of short-term benefit. I mean, Clinton was a China basher in his pre-election years and then shifted to a more rational policy. So I think they take it with a reasonable grain of salt. But I think there is a risk globally of alienating countries and people in dialogues, and certainly some of the Republican candidates' comments are not based in fact, and that ultimately that may come haunt them when they move towards a bid to actually become the president of the United States. So I think that they should perhaps, go to a more reasonable and rational level of concern. And certainly from a U.S. perspective, a North American perspective, some of China's policies or practices commercially as it's moved from a relatively isolated economy to a world player have not been what, in the same spirit of the WTO's general view of an even playing field. And those have to be watched, and those are legitimate concerns. But I think it's also has to be, again, put in some sort of rational vocabulary and more of a technical argument than bashing any country or any people.
So the question that's out there, that whether or not China will meet its target of a 7% GDP growth this year, aren't too many countries around the world that are even aspiring to such a growth rate?
It's an aggressive growth rate. I mean, originally they developed it in part because they had, certainly a decade ago when it started, they had a target that created a certain amount of jobs, and they had a demographic bulge that's slowing down in terms of youth coming into the economy, and they had employment targets. Yes, it is aggressive. I think it's difficult for any country, and I think that we're going to have to worldwide start looking to what's called steady-state economics and recognize that growth has an implication in areas that we don't like climate change and environment, and therefore we have to come up with a model that really focuses on the quality of that growth and the quality of people's lifestyles, and therefore governments are going to have to be able to move away from just one statistic and start looking at a basket of statistics. And to a certain extent, in some areas, that's what the Xi administration is trying to do, and not just be overly obsessed. But I think there are reasons for the slowdown in China, and certainly the world's status is one reason. I think that the anti-corruption campaign, when you have a centrally driven economy and a government-driven economy, and there's areas where 30-40% of the government officials are not at their desk, it makes it very hard to have government money flowing and state enterprises running when there's a deficit of decision-makers. And I'm not criticizing the removal of people for corrupt practices. I think that's a legitimate goal of somebody's on the take. They should be punished, but it also has an implication on the economy.
Well, there's a certain selectivity to it, though, isn't there? In terms of whether or not political enemies are nailed as opposed to truly corrupt officials.
I think at the high level, you can say that there's obviously some political rationale behind it, but when you're looking at certain provinces, where 40-50% of the people have been removed, I think there's a systemic problem, the reasons for that systemic problem are complex. I think that even if you look at what's happened in the stock market over the last year, what I would describe as government arbitrage, people on the inside have been able to take advantage of the market. There were deficits from a regulatory point of view and what we call the know the client rule. So unfortunately, the small investor got trampled at the end, but I think people understood the government wanted to increase the market's performance because they wanted to divest additional state resources. They wanted to, the Regulatory Commission and the CSRC wanted to list a number of companies, and they had a long queue of waiting for IPOs, so that was another reason to drive the market. There was obviously a lack of interest in real estate and a lack of performance, by and large, on bank deposits. So a lot of this money went into the market as you were opening up on the capital account. Foreigners were coming in under quota in a greater level than they had in the past. So all these things came together, and people on the inside understood this and took advantage of it, and the smart ones got out. But I think we also have to step back and say that on a one-year basis, the market performance has been pretty good. I'm not sure where it stands now with the latest number, but it was 43% earlier this week. probably down to 30% on the year end. So it's not as good as it was, obviously, at the bubble period, but it's not in the negative yet.
And in terms of the bubble, there's apparently a real estate bubble and a local government debt bubble. And of course, I imagine this debt bubble increases the long-term risk of a crash. But how would you rate it in terms of...
I think the areas of concern for real estate are in what we call the second-tier cities. The cities like Shenzhen and Guangzhou and Beijing and Shanghai have actually still have relatively good performance on real estate. But yes, I think there has been an overbuilding of real estate and luxury real estate by a lot of municipal governments. They're trapped into a worldwide problem, but it's acute in China, that the revenue base for most municipal governments and the actual mandate they have from the people or their constitution has a gap, and therefore they were relying on housing sales and land sales to fill that gap, and they were borrowing in an uncontrolled market, and China Development Bank and the central government through Ministry of Finance are moving in to try and understand that and clean it up and stabilize it. But it is obviously a big problem. And will, I think, ultimately be the area that people are going to have to watch, because we don't have the mechanisms for default at the local level. And therefore, the central government will have to step in and again take command of that, and that'll obviously have a fiscal burden.
Well, just in closing, do you think that there is any possibility of some of the big multinationals pulling out, like Apple? I mean, you're giving a picture of an economy that's just had a bit of a shock, but is in general strong and resilient, and heading towards, if they can't make the 7% GDP target, they may well get somewhere near it. So just your final appraisal, if you will.
Well, I don't think the majority of Fortune 500 or multinationals will pull out of China. I think that probably for the first time in 30 years, they'll look at their rate of return, internal rate of return on expanding their operations, depending on their business approach. I mean, obviously, Chinese handset sales fell or stabilized for the first time. And, and this is a culture where people have been, replacing their cell phones, almost on a quarterly or basis based on new models and new features. So I think people are also recognizing that, the changes are not as significant as they thought. And in a bad economy, they're holding on to their cell phone. But I think it would be not prudent for anybody to walk away from China based on, one or two quarters of growth, but they might look at, in terms of their short-term expansion plans, other emerging markets like Indonesia and India, where the Indian economy just topped over $2 trillion GDP, and it's got 10% growth, and it obviously has a big statistical potential, but has its own challenges from a market entry point of view that are similar in some ways to what we faced in China 20, 30 years ago, but also different because it's a more fragmented market economy with a different form of government. So I think multinationals might triage their growth, but I don't think anybody would pull out, with the one exception being people that are sourcing in China might find cheaper markets to do value-added labor in.
Well, John Gressler, I thank you so much for joining us here from Beijing.
You have a good day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with John Gressner, who is the principal and founder of Intercedent, a Canadian business and investment advisory firm founded in 1988 and focused on Asia. Mr. Gressner served as the head of the Canada-China Trade Council in Beijing, and he has lived and worked in China for over 30 years. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the behind-the-scenes diplomacy that could mean an end of the current civil war in Syria. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio. He has written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad, and Modern Syria, and his latest, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. David Lesh.
Pleasure to be here.
And there's a couple of headlines coming out of Syria, one surprising and the other one shocking. The first surprising one is that the Syrian government no longer controls up to 83% of the country. So this has been basically the Assad family's farm, if you will, and they've lost 83% of it. And this is according to Jane's Intelligence Review. And, of course, the other story is the shocking story of the blowing up of the 2,000-year-old Roman temple following the beheading of the Syrian archaeologist who'd made it his life works to preserve this UNESCO World Heritage Site at Palmyra. I believe you knew the 83-year-old archaeologist who was recently beheaded.
Yes, fairly well. I've been to Palmyra perhaps 8-9 times over the last 25 years, and on three of those occasions, he had personally led me on a tour of the area, and just a very, very sad occurrence for many, many reasons. He was so knowledgeable, but also a kind and gentle soul. And, frankly speaking, a lot of people have asked me, well, why didn't he leave when ISIS was threatening to take Palmyra? And my response is, would you abandon your children? And, the ruins were his children. He had been preserving them and developing them for 50 years, and so I think he had hoped he could save them from destruction.
Well, one of the things that I find extraordinary, though, about the coverage of Palmyra and also the desecration and destruction of priceless artifacts in Iraq by Daesh, the Islamic State, and now they're poised to destroy even more of Palmyra, is that the ideology, the religious ideology, or the religious doctrine that informs this kind of attack on what they consider to be idols, anything that's pre-Islamic, is basically the Saudi Wahhabi doctrine. So why are we all of our commentators and politicians, why are they letting the Saudis off the hook here?
Because they own, or under their deserts and land, are 25% of the world's oil reserves, and a swing producer in OPEC. And I know that's a fairly cynical approach, but I think that's the bottom line, and they've long been an ally. But I think it's an ally that we've begun to realize that the ideology that they have spread, either officially or unofficially, or with a blind eye, that it's causing a lot of problems. And I think they're finally realizing the blowback it causes in Saudi Arabia itself. So you can't just get away with promoting this type of extremist Salafist Islam in various areas without it coming back to bite you and without it causing other problems in the region. It's very short-sighted, but unfortunately that's the way that most governments act, in a very short-sighted, expedient, immediate fashion.
Well, in line with what you're telling us, Dr. David Lesh, Russia apparently brokered a meeting that took place recently between Syrian and Saudi intelligence officials. And earlier this month, Russian and Saudi foreign ministers met in Moscow. Also, on the other side, if you will, of this proxy war, the Iranian foreign minister, he was meeting Assad in Damascus, I think it was last week. And I think a couple of weeks ago, Secretary of State Kerry and Lavrov, his Russian counterpart, and Saudi foreign ministry people held their first three-way meeting on Syria. So in terms of the Saudis waking up, the fact that they've been having secret talks with the Syrian intelligence, what do you think that's going to lead to?
Well, I think two things are driving this. One is the fact that the Syrian government has experienced a number of losses lately. While it's certainly not lingering on the brink of existence, you mentioned earlier they've lost 83% of Syria. However, that 17% that remains is the majority of the population in Syria and in most of the major cities that are still under the regime's control. It is still the single most powerful actor in Syria. However, since they have many enemies, they have willingly contracted
their positions and so forth. So I think that's one driving factor, that the Syrian government has been weakened, and therefore they themselves have perhaps expressed an interest in a negotiated settlement. And then the second thing that is driving this, of course, is the U.S.-Iranian, or the P5 plus one Iranian nuclear deal that has maybe reordered or beginning to reset the regional balance of power. And the productive relationship that may develop between the U.S. and Iran, U.S. and Russia, which of course helped broker the deal, all of these things are, I think, contributing to this moment, or at least the identification of this moment where perhaps a negotiated solution may be, more realistic or even possible than it has been in the past. And the U.N. Special Envoy has also put forth a new plan, a new U.N. Security Council resolution, endorsing his efforts. So a lot of things, a lot of strands are coming together. We're a long way away because there are many unknown elements to this, and the Syrian government saying or indicating it might show some more interest in a negotiated settlement is a far cry from them actually doing something to make it happen. And then there's still the question of the opposition. It's still just as fragmented and fractured, and how do we get a critical mass of the opposition, non Jabhat al-Nusra and non-ISIS opposition, to come to the table and negotiate with the Syrian government. So these things are still out there, but this is a moment, and people are recognizing that this could be a moment toward a negotiated settlement.
Well, of course, the fact that Russia and China vetoed early resolutions to force an early settlement in the spirit, if you will, of the Arab Spring, and after the fall of Gaddafi, the Syrian people rose up against Bashar al-Assad's the family government to demand their rights, and of course they were just slaughtered, and thus the agony began. I guess it's too much in foreign policy to ask the Syrians and the Russians and the Chinese to take responsibility for this hideous situation that they've created.
Yeah, well, I think Russia in particular, and perhaps Iran now, I mean, they recognize that they may lose their interest in Syria if they just let things go as things seem to be progressing right now with the continued weakening of the Assad regime. So perhaps, show some more willingness for a negotiated solution that may preserve their strategic interest in Syria, which is what they've wanted from the very beginning. There's no love for Assad, but he just simply represents the preservation of their mutual interests in Syria right now. And so, it's a number of these strands perhaps coming together on this. Everybody wants an off-ramp out of this situation. The U.S. has wanted it. Russia wants it. Iran wants it. Something to just get out of this quagmire that will preserve what remains of Syrian state institutions, so there's not state collapse and utter chaos that may spread even more so in the region, and lead towards some sort of transition that may or may not include Assad, so that there can be some identifiable, rump Syrian state that can join in the fight against ISIS. And I think that's the wish list of the outside powers right now, and I think most of the regional powers. But wishing it and making it happen are two different things.
Well, it seems that at least there's been some specialists like Nicholas Harris, who I spoke to recently, suggested that if Daesh, the Islamic State, destroy Palmyra, and they've started to do that, that could create international backlash. Do you think that, given that nobody's really done much so far to stop this agony, do you think after, 250,000 people have died, suddenly the world is going to wake up because a UNESCO World Heritage Site has been destroyed?
Yeah, with all due respect to Nicholas, who I like and is a friend, I don't think there's a way in hell that the international community is going to act if Palmyra is destroyed. As you said, 250,000 lives lost didn't do it. So a few more ancient relics and archaeological sites, even though it's one of the best in the world, I don't think is going to do it. And what a hypocritical, sad act that would be if that's what, that's what elicited the an international response, rather than the killing of the deaths of 250,000 people and the destruction of a country.
And the displacement of, 11 million people so far?
Yeah, 11 million, half the country, the country. Such
and
a tragedy.
And they're creating a tremendous crisis in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Mediterranean Sea has become the most dangerous and well-traveled border crossing in the world. It's not the U.S.-Mexican border. And, you know, the problem with that is that, you know, the first countries, it's a geography situation. The first countries these people hit from instability in North Africa and the Eastern Mediterranean, they hit countries like Greece and Italy and so forth. And these are the countries that can at least afford to deal with this, especially Greece. And, you know, there's an EU law that says that, you know, migrants that come in, the country that where they land, they are responsible for processing and documenting these migrants and then dealing with them. And that's why, you know, Greece and some other countries are just trying to prevent them from coming in, because once they come in, they're responsible. And they have enough trouble keeping their own population at work and their governments in power. So it's a terrible situation, and it's horrible for these refugees.
So, Dr. David Lesh, just following up, though, on these meetings brokered by Russia between Saudi and its Syrian intelligence, the meetings of the Saudi and Russian foreign ministers in Moscow, the meetings of Iran's foreign minister in Damascus with Assad, and then Secretary of State Kerry and Lavrov, his Russian counterpart, and the Saudi foreign minister also having a meeting, would indicate that there's some activity, and you've mentioned the possible contours of a deal. But wouldn't at the end of the day, if you could save Syria from complete state collapse, wouldn't you then have a second war to eliminate Daesh, the Islamic State?
Yes. In fact, many of the Syrian opposition that I've talked to, armed opposition as well as civilian opposition, even Syrian government people and pro-government elements with whom I've spoken over the last year since the rise of ISIS, they all talk about the next war. They all talk that, you know, in fact, some are saying, you know, let's try as best we can to get a negotiated settlement so then we can turn our rifles and arms and artillery toward ISIS, because that's the real enemy. So, you know, that's a possible unifying element. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's everyone wants to a settlement on their terms right now, which is natural, but you know, the opposition itself is so fragmented and so many different groups and so many different powerful groups that it's going to be very, very difficult to get a critical mass of the opposition to the table and agree to something with the government, a government that at this point still doesn't want to give up Bashar al-Assad, and he doesn't want to leave. And there has to be, you know, there has to be the right formula at the right time and the right circumstances, and we're getting there, and hopefully we'll get there soon enough with the regional and international actors on board, applying the necessary pressures on their various proxy forces, and get this deal done. But yes, this is just ending the first war, the civil war. If the Islamic State continues as it has been, there will be another one.
So, trying to get my head around the idea of how that could be accomplished. I mean, I've heard of something called the flypaper strategy, where you get all the bad guys in one spot and then you kill them. There is some geography would suggest that that's possible, but it can't be done by Western powers. They have no credibility in that region. Turkey seems ambivalent. At least Erdogan's playing a very cynical game, beating up on the Kurds while he's pretending to beat up on ISIS. The Israelis would have their agenda, and they're certainly not popular in the Arab world. Who could do it?
Well, no one. And that's why everyone is looking to the U.S. In fact, no one else in the world can do it but the U.S. And of course, you know, we're not going to do it. We haven't done it thus far for, depending what side you're on, for good reasons or not so good reasons. But certainly the American public, you know, which the Obama administration, they're reading the polls, does not want another war in the Middle East, and they don't want to get sucked into one by becoming too military involved in Syria. So I think this is a situation that, you know, the parties themselves in Syria, along with international coaxing and mediation, and, of course, pressure from regional partners and international partners, will get, you know, enough of each side together to at least settle most of the Syrian civil war that exists so that they can turn their attentions towards saving what's left of Syria and then moving against ISIS, which I think would happen fairly quickly, because then everyone would finally be on the same side, the domestic, regional, international communities against ISIS. And I think that's when you'll see ISIS really shrink and implode.
And Dr. David Lesh, you were just in Lebanon. Is there any rumors of war there? I've heard some express that Israel's always wanted to finish off the job with Hezbollah, and Hezbollah are deeply, perhaps even overextended, saving the Assad regime along with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Because there's no question that Assad's running out of manpower and he's recruiting young Alawites who are just not up, you know, they're just basically not able to fight these ISIS people who are pretty ruthless. So is there any sense that this, in other words, one of the former National Intelligence Council head for the Middle East recently wrote a piece suggesting that this might happen and that the collateral effect would be that Netanyahu could torpedo the deal that is now before the Senate?
Well, yeah, he could by starting another war in the region and attacking Hezbollah. I don't think they will. I think they're getting the best of many worlds right now with Hezbollah, you know, getting cut down to size a little bit by committing so much in Syria at the same time that the Assad regime has been cut down to size. Now, you know, they don't want an Islamic State victory, but as one leading Israeli general told me, we'll deal with that if it comes. You know, they're not really worried about that, radical Islamists, not as worried as Hezbollah. So I think right now in Lebanon, they're more worried about getting their trash picked up because of the government dysfunction. And that's what the recent riots were about. And the one thing about Lebanon that most countries don't have, Syria will probably have this in the future, unfortunately, is that they went through 15 years of horrible civil war. So they have that historical memory. And so most Lebanese, you know, even in a situation that would cause most countries to fracture, and with this influx of millions of Syrian refugees disrupting the Lebanese economy, they won't, for now, because with that historical memory of what happened in the past, they'll do anything and compromise when needed to not go through that again. And you know, they've been toughened up in that sense, and they've learned to make the necessary compromises and to exist essentially without a government, in order to prevent another 15-year or generation-long civil war. And the Syrians will probably have that too if they ever can reconstitute themselves in another generation or so.
So at least that's one complication that you don't think we should worry about.
Well, we should worry about it. Lebanon is always a country that seems to be on the precipice, but you know, you talk to the people there and so forth, and particularly in Beirut, they get by, they make the necessary compromises. But on the other hand, even with that attitude, you know, you can still get completely overwhelmed by the Syrian war next door and by more refugees coming in, or by Jabhat al-Nusra or ISIS establishing cells in Lebanon and causing troubles, particularly in the north in Tripoli, which is anti-Assad and more Sunni-based. So, there's always that possibility, but it's not nearly as much as I think many people think.
Well, Dr. David Lesh, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio. He has written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States from Bush to Obama, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad, and Modern Syria. And his latest book is Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with an assessment of President Obama's speech at Monday's National Clean Energy Summit in Las Vegas. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Freeman, a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Jimmy Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence and Energy Insider Shows How. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Freeman.
Well, thank you for having me.
The president on Monday in Las Vegas gave a keynote speech to about 1,000 people gathered at the National Clean Energy Summit 8.0. And most of the focus was on solar energy. And I know you've probably been the leading proponent of solar energy in the country. What was your impression of what the president had to say?
Oh, the president gives an excellent speech about climate and about solar energy. He is a very gifted speaker, and I think in his own way, he means what he says. But there was one person missing at that audience. You know who that was?
Who?
Mother Nature. She didn't hear the speech. She only absorbs the greenhouse gases that keep going up. And green talk and good talk is not going to reduce the greenhouse gases. Let's get a fact in the air here. 75% of the greenhouse gases being emitted around the world are not from coal. They're from oil and gas. Let me say it again. Three-quarters of the problem is oil and gas, and yet our president brags about how we are now the world's largest producer of oil and how we are fracking our way into fracking heaven. I mean, his clean power program deals only with the current uses of electricity. In other words, as though you have a three-ring circus and you're only trying to play in one ring. And in that ring, what is he doing? He is saying that that we should reduce carbon. Well, Lord knows we should, and Mother Nature knows that. But Mother Nature is also aware that natural gas is methane. The methane leaks as part of the transportation and mining and drilling system, and it for 20 years is 100 times more potent than carbon, and then it tapers off slightly over a long period of years. But the scientists tell us that if we add the impact of the methane to the impact of carbon, which is only half as bad in natural gas as coal, you end up with natural gas emitting about as much or more greenhouse gases per unit of energy as coal. So it's like switching from Lucky Strikes to Camels. You still get cancer of the lungs. While I admire his promoting verbally and also doing a few things with respect to solar, if we were able to make the entire electric power system 100% carbon free and greenhouse gas free, we would have solved one third of the problem. But we're not even doing that because I ran five electric utilities in my life, and I know those guys. They are resistant to change, and while there are a lot of promotion and a lot of solar that's coming on, and we'll get to that in a minute, they're just changing from coal to natural gas, and that will comply with the so-called ambitious clean power program of President Obama. So while his heart's in the right place and his message is great, he hasn't done the one thing that we need to do, and that is outlaw new natural fossil fuel power plants. I mean, why in the name of heaven don't we use the only thing that a community has to do to assert its collective will, and that is the force of law? Why his power program says, yeah, you can comply with my program by switching to natural gas or doing solar, all of the above. But the Lord in heaven knows that that some of the above is contaminating the above. And anyhow, so my heart goes out to the people that don't have knowledge of the subject, which is most of the people. But while we're saying good words here, and true, we're promoting solar some, but you know where it's being promoted? It's being promoted by state laws that require the utilities to get a higher and higher percentage of solar each year. And the truth of the matter is the prices have gone down to where we could have an all-electric, all-renewable economy in 35 years if we just unleash the marketing power of the electric power industry, which has no interest in and is adverse to really growing the way they could, but growing with renewable energy. So, you know, we got a situation where it's the worst of all worlds. We have a remedy, but it's going to take the force of law to electrify the railroads. It's going to take the force of law to make Detroit stop making fossil fuel burning cars and start making hydrogen and all electric cars on a massive scale, and require people to switch, you know, from burning natural gas to using either renewable hydrogen or heat pumps to heat with. We have the technology. And I've got a book coming out with my friend Leah Parks in Fall Calling, An All-Electric America, that shows exactly how it can be done and how we can actually save money over time. And that's what's so heartbreaking. But we have an electric power industry that is resistant to change. Well, they're used to being regulated. Let's just pass some damn laws and require them to make everything new, renewable, and to start expanding and get some laws on the books to make the automobile companies start making more and more zero-emission vehicles and require the railroads to electrify. This could be the growth issue, the pattern of economic growth for the next 20 or 30 years, and we could show the world how to do it, just like those three kids did over in France the other day.
So the price of solar power dropped 78% from 2009 to 2014. The price of wind power dropped 58%. Solar provides less than 1% of electricity generated in the U.S. And in 2014, renewable energy sources provided 13% of the nation's electricity, about half of which came from hydroelectric dams, a third from wind, and 3% from solar. That's according to federal data. So why can't we, you know, if the technology's there, as you pointed out, and it's been there for years, what's happening with, for example, here with the Department of Water and Power? Lots of people out in the community listening to you at this moment, David Freeman, want to switch to solar. They want to do it, but it's not easy to do. And the utility companies are not encouraging it and not doing what the Germans do, where every household is a little generator and you can put your what surplus electricity is sent back into the grid.
Well, it's a question of enough people asking that question. Why aren't they doing it? And I think it's an absence of leadership. It's an absence of knowledge. I don't think that the average person understands that not only do we have low-cost solar and wind, but we now have developed storage technology. So this myth about, you know, what are you going to do at night? Well, you know, you just go back to the Bible where the Lord told the Israelites that when you have a good year, you store some of the grain for a bad year. Well, we now have devices called batteries and flywheels and compressed air and other technologies where you can take the solar when it's available in the daytime and take the wind available when it's wind blows and store some of it so you have enough so we can have around-the-clock renewable energy. We don't need fossil fuels. We don't need nuclear power. Mother Nature, I mean, get right down to it. Mother Nature has given us and is delivering free of charge more energy than we could ever possibly need. We now learn how to harness it and store it. Why haven't we got the common sense to make everything new based on that? And we have the technologies now where that solar electricity can drive our cars, can run our railroads, can heat our homes, and can be converted to hydrogen so that some uses where electricity doesn't work, you can burn hydrogen where you're now burning oil or gas. We have the technology. The modern-day Edisons have invented it, and we have an industry that really is regulated that just needs to be told what to do. But somehow or another, we can't seem to get the political courage to use the word mandate. We keep going to indirect measures like, oh, we need a carbon tax. Well, we've been needing a carbon tax for 50 years, and Congress won't pass one. And even if you passed a tax, that isn't going to overcome the resistance that exists. It's economic today to electrify the railroads. They're not doing it. The railroads don't have the capital. We need a government program just like we had one to build the interstate highway. You know, we have a government for one purpose, and that is to do the things that we can't do individually that need to get done. And Lord knows, if you either believe the scientists and you say this climate issue is the death knell for our grandchildren, if you believe it and don't do anything about it, you're not any better than the deniers that don't believe it. And my problem is that we have this sophisticated class of deniers that can talk eloquently about the problem, but don't seem to have the political courage to say that we need to order the utilities to stop building anything more that contaminates and build only the things that don't contaminate, which are available and long-term cheaper. Oh, it's just frustrating that somehow or another the debate about climate isn't even talking about three-quarters of the problem, the transportation sector, the heating sector, and all the uses that we have. We're talking only about the current use of electricity, which is about 40% of the problem, and part of that is clean. Part of that is hydro, a little bit of it. But the clean power program of the president, to my mind, is fundamentally misleading because it's being attacked by the coal industry. The average person thinks he's really doing some good when it's a pitiful program compared to what needs to be done. So, and the book that we have coming out, All Electric America, lays out a comprehensive effort that needs to be done, but it involves mandates. For goodness sakes, when we had a problem with DDT and the birds were dying, we outlawed the stuff. Now, I'm a utility guy. We can't just turn the lights off, but surely we can say everything new has to be renewable and not have a complicated program of all kind of stuff where, in order to comply, all a utility has to do is just switch from one poison to another. There's a loophole there big enough for everybody to climb through, and that's what they're doing. They have already met half of President Obama's so-called ambitious goal on carbon by switching to natural gas, which has already taken place. But it's not helping the climate any, because Mother Nature counts all that methane, even though he doesn't count it.
Well, so when the president on Monday in Las Vegas said to the National Clean Energy Summit that when you start seeing massive lobbying efforts backed by fossil fuel interests or conservative think tanks or the Koch brothers pushing for new laws to roll back renewable energy standards or to prevent new clean energy business from succeeding, that's a problem. What you're telling us is that may be a problem, but the bigger problem is political courage.
Correct. You don't hear the natural gas industry jumping his program. That's the tip-off. You don't hear the oil industry really blasting him. It's the coal industry. And the coal industry's dying because they need to die. you know, it's local poison, and it's poisoning the air, and natural gas is cheaper. But that just because it's cheaper doesn't mean that it isn't a problem for the climate. And if I said it three times now, if you combine the methane with the carbon, it's worse than coal. This latest study showed that they found one leak, one place in the natural gas system that was leaking at the gathering places that they hadn't even counted. And the leakage from there is the equivalent of 37 coal-fired power plants that they're not counting. Well, Mother Nature counts it. You know, we can't win this climate battle by fooling ourselves and ignoring what's inconvenient. Al Gore really picked the right word when he said an inconvenient truth. We're just picking our fights here on the basis of political expediency and convenience. We've got to put the oil and gas people out of business over the next 35 years if we're going to, our grandchildren are going to have a livable planet. That's the bottom line. And why are we giving out any more leases at all? It is maddening that this, the President of the United States is allowing the oil industries to start drilling in the Arctic now. They ought not be drilling anywhere. I mean, we ought to be starting to reduce the use of oil and gas 1 year at a time. That should be our program. We need a 3% program where we cut greenhouse gases across the board 3% a year by law and enforce it with a huge fee, to the extent that nobody achieves it, a huge fee that goes to the Internal Revenue Service. I've laid all this out in my forthcoming book. It doesn't have much chance of being enacted anytime soon. But we need to change the debate so that it's enacted before it's too late.
Well, David Freeman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yeah, I hope that this is an optimistic message because the technology is there if we just go figure out how to make the utility industry use it and sell it. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Freeman, who's a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon, headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Jimmy Carter, and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider shows how. And his forthcoming book is All Electric America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.